Don't be silly. You're taking the fall.
My name is Stephen Nestor, and you're listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Today we have with us Ken Harville, author of Kill Whitey, an Ugly Town Press publication. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
When the Lynch crime family, an already off-center family unit, recruits the help of prodigal son Leon Whitey Lynch, you know that when the going gets tough, the tough get even stranger in the odd little city of Butcher Harbor. Ken, you've created quite an alternate universe of crime here. There's everything about this book that's a little bit off-center, a little bit original, and really gives the reader something they would never really quite expect.
Oh, thank you.
And tell us, what was the inspiration for this book, Kill Whitey?
The inspiration for the city of Butcher's Harbor, I grew up here in the Northeast, so it's really based on a lot of these strange cities that I've known. I really don't want to offend anybody, but Willimantic was kind of a strong inspiration for Butcher's Harbor. And another place I lived in for a while was called Oneyville, which is a section of Rhode Island. And it's not only that these places have a lot of crime and a lot of addiction and prostitution and problems, but there's just something weird about these places where everyone and everything just seems a little bit off. And I think I say at one point in the book, it looks like everybody was drawn by an artist that lost control of his pen and his mind. And that's the feeling I get in a couple of these towns that I've known growing up in the Northeast. And I just tried to skew it a little bit and make it stranger for Butcher's Harbor.
I know, that's something that I had to, I marked that in my book myself, because Butcher's Harbor is such an odd place, and you say on page 52, the streets of Butcher's Harbor, they drove past condemned slaughterhouses and abandoned factories, hollow fossils of an extinct economy. The only semi-thriving, semi-legal industries in Butcher's Harbor were blocks upon blocks of dive bars, shot-in-the-beer liquor stores, strip clubs, pornographic superstores, porn shops, and little offices with block letter signs advertising cash for car titles. You keep car. It's an ominous place. It's a little bit sounds like South Boston redecorated by William S. Burroughs.
Well, the cash for car titles is Dover in Delaware. But yeah, it's just a hodgepodge of all kinds of things I've seen. And yeah, Southie definitely. I lived outside of Southie for a while, South Boston, and I call it the cities that are kind of rotting in the shadows of New York City and Boston, and it's where I grew up.
Rotting in the shadows of love. Hey, this is a pretty original crime family, the Lynches. They're about as memorable as the Pritzies. You've got a man by the name of Increase Lynch. He's the dad. You know, Increase. That's a name that's, you know, didn't Cotton Mather have a kid named Increase?
Yeah, he had a brother named Increase Mather,
which is pretty scary. And then you've got son Wyatt Lynch, and then you've got Leon Whitey Lynch. Now, and what we have here is a family unit that tries to come together under the duress of a crime war. Tell us a little bit about Whitey. He's a very interesting character.
Whitey, well, he's just an alienated character. He's a drug dealer, but he doesn't sell the normal line of drugs. His products include things like zombie potions and harmony filters, memory teas, and he's got that adrenaline-boosting drug called BMF. And he's just traveled the world collecting this stash. He's gone, he's collected some seaweed off of Molokai, and he's gotten some pine sap from Madagascar. He just really traveled the world getting this really great collection. And along the way, he's trying to connect with people, too, because he's odd, you know. He had that abusive childhood. He had the trauma in his childhood, so he's just prone towards depression and alienation, and that's only intensified more because he's an albino. He doesn't look like other people, so he's desperate for some kind of connection, and that's why he's been traveling around the world in addition to collecting that stash, and just doesn't fit in anywhere else, so kind of out of desperation, he comes back home to Butcher's Harbor to try and connect with his family, even though anyone would tell you it's just a terrible idea. He just, his brother's a psychopath, and his dad's a little better, but he's no particularly savory character either.
Yeah, Dad's kind of a, we'll get into him later, but Whitey comes back, Whitey's only half a family member, and he's only half a white guy.
Yeah. Yeah. His mom was a prostitute, a Haitian, and his father is an Irish gangster. And that's an interesting thing, too, about Whitey and Wyatt. I might be getting off subject a little bit, but one of the parallels between these two brothers is I think they're both kind of mama's boys. They both miss their mothers. Whitey lost his mom to drugs, and when he was taken in by Increase, he basically shamed Wyatt's mother to leaving. So that's one thing that these two have in common. But they are certainly a dysfunctional family.
But they have each other. They seem to work well together only because in the crime family milieu, you know, you just don't have a father and a brother, a father's son two sons, you know, half brothers. You've also got many, many, many other people who are part of this crime family, and that's what makes the book so. There are a lot of colorful characters in here, so there's always something, someone new, and something interesting popping up because this is it's kind of a character-driven book.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I tried to, you know, even if a character was only going to last for a few pages, I really wanted to get very much into their head and to create something memorable, even if the person was going to die within, you know, five pages. And those are really just, I really don't have a lot of experience with lots of writing, so a lot of this was just kind of winging it and figuring it out on my own, but I've met some interesting people, and I just kind of tried to combine many different personalities into these various characters.
Well, that's interesting you say that. I mean, you've written a book that really takes on we have to suspend our disbelief because you create this alternate world that's just slightly off-key where people wear dolphin hide jackets. Where a Deus Ex Machina in the shape of a tornado just changes everything, and you know your writing is more competent than I'd say the subject matter. I mean, but so well, I'm curious. Why do you say you're an inexperienced writer?
Oh, because I haven't written much. I'm a technical writer by trade, and I just wrote this book on a lark. You know, I really haven't taken a whole lot of creative writing classes or anything like that. I've never really studied the craft. I just enjoy reading, and I enjoy storytelling. I enjoy stories. I enjoy movies. And I just thought I'd take a crack at writing my own novel. Just, I don't know, I read all the stuff, and I thought, I can do that. And I just took a crack at it, and it seems like people like it. But when I say I'm not much of a writer by experience, it's because I'm not, you know. It kind of came out of the blue.
Well, what prompted you to, to go into genre fiction, which is a very heavy, you know, mysteries and crime books are heavily read, and most fledgling writers, it seems, I write, you know, the coming of age novel. While you, in fact, have written a book number one that talks a lot about pharmacopoeia.
Yeah.
Using natural ingredients, natural herbs and stuff for medicinal purposes, and you've also written a crime novel, which is heavily read and. It's going to be heavily critiqued and heavily criticized. Why did you pick something like this?
You know, everyone thinks that I'm this hardcore crime novel fan, and I'm not. I enjoy reading Elmore Leonard. I enjoyed reading, I think his name is Scott Phillips, who wrote The Ice Harvest, which is fantastic. But I'm not really that avid of a reader of the genre. I think I came to it by way of films, you know, movies like Pulp Fiction and Goodfellas and... I like gangster film first and foremost, and it's only when I started writing the gangster novel and people started saying, you remind me of so-and-so and this person and that person, now I'm becoming a fan of the genre, but I wasn't when I started writing it. I was influenced more by things like, I think you can see very much the magical realism, things like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Colson Whitehead. Those were a big influence on my writing. But obviously Hunter S. Thompson, too. But as far as the gangster stuff, well, no. Nah, I mean, I think I picked it by way of by movies.
How about Jonathan Lethem?
Jonathan Lethem, yeah, he's fantastic. I've only read Fortress of Solitude, but he didn't influence this book because I read it afterwards, but that's kind of the spirit of what I'm going for,
The gun with occasional music's got talking animals in it. I mean, it's like it's Who Shot Roger Rabbit on acid, you know?
Yeah. I didn't hear that. I heard people saying the gang that couldn't shoot straight meets Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but Roger Rabbit on acid's good too.
Well, we try to please our guests on Poets of the Tabloid Murder. Well, the book revolves basically around there's some fifth columnists, some quislings inside the Lynch gang, and Leon gets a role in the family. He's asked to participate in some family matters, and he uses his truth serum, and they find the spies. They've got some great names, these guys. Who are they? Benny One Too Many Vega and
One Eye Can Ivan Ivan.
One Eye Can Ivan Ivan, the little lawyer. And there's a Swag Kilpatrick.
So yeah.
There's the three rats. And they're all they're taken care of in great fashion. Without giving too much away, I just will say that I liked it when Swag was eaten by high-octane, flesh-eating, doped-up Nazi rats.
Yeah. It was even more far out when I first wrote it, and I had to tone it down a bit. It was a little too much like a Kafka novel at points, and I had to give some kind of storyline that people could grasp onto. But
well, I got to say, that's okay. You've got to be far out or a little bit adventurous in this mystery genre, because you're either going to read a book like this. You're going to read very competent books like Elmore Leonard and Donald Westlake, and they're going to keep you entertained. And then, you're going to read everything else is really, old ladies with their cats baking cookies, trying to solve crimes in their kitchen, for crying out loud. Which, I mean, have you delved that much into the genre to know that there's a lot of dross out there?
Yeah. My wife reads that kind of stuff. I don't even know the names of the authors, but there's it always seems there's some kind of gimmick, like she's a chef who solves crimes, and then they can have recipes right in the mystery book. I mean, that's one that's really out there.
Yeah, compared to this other stuff, your book is a breath of fresh sewage.
Oh, well, thank you.
And that means that as a compliment.
Yeah. Exactly. I was more in the spirit of just trying to combine different genres. Even there's a little bit of cyberpunk and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's some science fiction in there.
Yeah,
without a doubt. Well, what are you going to do next? I mean, you've written this book. I mean, you're a technical writer, so you're kind of in shape. You do it every day. You're practicing your sentences every day and trying to explain whatever it is you're trying to explain to people. Computer systems or Toro lawnmowers.
Adhesives, in my case.
Pardon me.
Industrial adhesives. Yeah.
Somewhere out there in central Connecticut. So, I mean, what's Act Two going to be for you? I mean, you found yourself. I mean, you went out and you found yourself a nice little boutique publisher in L.A., Ugly Town. And you've got to follow this up.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of interest in it. That's been cool. There's a lot of interest in a sequel. The first novel really kind of begs for a sequel.
Because the title is just the title is only addressed on the last page. Kill Whitey.
Right.
Whitey, of course, is Leon Lynch. Because he's a albino mulatto.
Yeah.
And there's room for another book to happen. Have you begun working on this?
It's well underway, yeah. And I'm really proud of that. I think that people are going to be, if they enjoy Kill White, they're really going to like the sequel. I think it takes it in much more strange direction to flesh things out. I dropped a few seeds in the first, as I was doing my final revisions, I dropped in a little things to set up for the sequel. And whereas the first novel use drugs to drive the surrealism, the second novel is going to use kind of metaphysical religions and voodoo, Santeria, and the afterlife to really drive the surrealism a whole other level.
So it sounds like we've got ancient Egyptians and Port-au-Prince, Haiti kind of rolled up into there.
Kind of, yeah.
And you did get us used to some zombieism, if that's what it's called. The zombie thing figures into Kill Whitey.
Yep.
So you've got us prepared for that. And with some of these drugs that you've made up, like you've got a drug called Hoom, H-O-O-M, which gives you a wild buzz and a photographic memory.
Yeah.
You, I mean, your book is full of substances like that. I just have to just confirm and reassure me that you're making this up.
Oh, of course, yeah. It's funny. Some really educated people said, how'd you learn about all these drugs? And well, they're made up. And he thought they were all real.
They're just trying to kiss up to you.
Yeah. Well, whom? These are drugs that I wish existed. I mean, when I was studying for my comprehensive exams, I wish I had a drug that would give me photographic memory, So some of it was coming out of an area of stuff that I wish to exist.
It might exist out there in the Amazon. They're just finding these things out now, Ken.
Right.
You know, scientists are racing to the Amazon before it's cut down to find these miracle drugs out.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I know some people who work at Pfizer, and they say there are some strange drugs out there that they're just not marketing.
Yeah,
it is amazing what they can do to the mind and body.
You just can't take them. Yeah. But we're speaking with Ken Harvis, author of Kill Whitey, an Ugly Town Press publication. This is Ken's first book, and it's a doozy. Okay, this is your first book. This is what all your fans want to know. What was the odyssey of getting your first novel published? I mean, we kind of got a feeling of how you came about writing it, but what did you do after you wrote it? How did you get in contact with Ugly Town?
The whole thing was remarkably easy for me. I mean, I wrote it on a lark, and I didn't make a real serious effort in trying to find a publisher. I just kind of sent it out, and these guys liked it, and they picked it up. And I hate to say that, because I know some people really try for a long time to find a publisher, but I just kind of fell into a group that was a good niche for me. I tried finding some agents, and the agents didn't really want to have anything to do with me, because I had absolutely no track record. I hadn't even published so much as a short story, and I wasn't a columnist for a paper. I really had no kind of audience. So I went to the publishers directly, and I got some pretty good responses from a few houses, but they all passed on it. And then I read this book called Dirt by Sean Doolittle, which I thought was just really wacky and funny. And I thought, I bet these guys would be hip to Kill Whitey.
And that would be Ugly Town, right?
And that was Ugly Town, yeah.
Tom Fassbinder
and Jim Pasco. And, so I sent this pitch letter to them and three chapters. Didn't hear from them for 6 months, and then they called me back and say, yep, we dig it, we want it. Why don't you send us the whole manuscript? So I sent that out. Didn't hear from them for another 6 months, and then they said, we want it, we'll buy it. And I think it was about maybe almost a year later when it finally got onto the shelf. But it was just kind of fell into place for me. It wasn't, the whole thing was just kind of a happy series of coincidences. It's not like I really set out to do this as something I've always wanted to do since I was a little kid. I just fallen into it, and I like it, and I got more stories coming.
Are you afraid that you're...
I'm a one-trick pony?
No. Are you afraid that your beginner's luck is going to curse you somehow? You will continue to write the books, but that it just won't happen again, or you just can't do it again?
I don't think so. I think that the sequel that I'm working on is fantastic. Without sounding immodest, I really think it's good. I think I've just kind of stumbled into something that I'm good at, and it's something that I want to do a lot more of.
Well, give us a little hint about what the next book is. I'm going to assume that Leon Whitey Lynch lives again.
Okay, that's a good assumption.
Okay, it's a sequel. He better.
Leon is going to be a much happier person at the start of the sequel. He and his brother pretty much reverse. Leon is incredibly happy and well-adjusted. He belongs to a commune up in Vermont, and he's now gone commercial with his drugs. He's selling this kind of watered-down version of his drugs in these teas that do things like, sort of like St. John's Wort curing depression and stuff that cures constipation. But he's got these little religious quotations attached to the tea bags. So he's got this little cult following, and he's very happy. For the first time in his life, he's found this kind of community where he fits in.
Does he find love with Macy?
No. With somebody else, but Macy does come back to complicate that nice relationship that he's got. It takes place 5 years after the end of Kill Whitey. And Wyatt is living in isolation. He's terrified of the Willies, which is this insanity-inducing virus. And he's living in isolation down in Texas above a strip club, running a few seedy operations. And I don't want to say too much more than that.
You don't have to.
There are a strange series of things that bring these two brothers back together and end up flipping them again so that they're back into their more comfortable positions of Leon being in this state of alienation.
Who's going to publish this book?
Oh, Ugly Town is very interested in the sequel.
You haven't sold it yet?
No, I haven't sold it yet. Not on the contract or anything.
Ugly Town took a chance on you. A small press in L.A. They published? They published Scott Phillips' first book, I believe.
Yeah.
They published both of Sean Doolittle's and a couple other guys.
Victor Geisler.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And he's really taken off now with Dell, and so is Doolittle's going with Dell too.
So, are you going to reward these guys by letting them have book two, or you know, suppose Random House comes up to you and says, you know, eh?
Right, right. Well, here's the thing. I have thought about that. I mean, I've had agents approaching me.
You can speak freely because they're listening right now.
Okay. I have had agents approaching me, and they're telling me that if I want to make money, I have to move beyond Uglytown. But I don't know if that's true anymore. Uglytown has been picked up by Publishers Group West, and they have much more marketing muscle than they had when they were with their original distributor.
They put out some good books, you know?
They put out great books, and the work that they did on the cover of Kill Whitey is just it's fantastic, and I don't think any other house would have done that.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying, and the other thing is, you know, I've gone into bookstores in Barnes & Noble, and I'm looking for Doolittle and Geisler stuff with Dell, and I can't find it. I was looking for Don Lee, who got nominated for an Edgar for his Country of Origin. I couldn't find it. But my book is face out right next to Carl Hyacinth's book. So Uglytown has a following, and I would like to reward them with do my sequel with them. And the book is hot. I mean, they're really excited about it, and there's a buzz all the way from L.A. to London right now. So
that's good for you.
Well, thank you, yeah.
Yeah, they really did a nice design with this book. Now, on the edge of the book, you know, where if it was like a textbook, you'd write your name on the pages.
Yeah.
And then you'd move them around, and it would you know, your name would stretch. Well, if you push the pages one way, it says Kill. If you push the pages the other way, it says Whitey.
Yep.
So, which is, they really, you know, I'm sure that's not cheap to do. And, you know, the book feels nice. It's a nice size. It fits in your hand. Well, they really put some thought into this.
Yeah, they absolutely did. And I know Pasco had spent a lot of time figuring out how to do that. And actually messed things up at the printer and delayed the printing because those little blocks of ink that spell out the Kill and Whitey weren't lined up the first time. So that's the kind of extra touch that Uglytown does that, well, you know, I on a personal level, I'm into kind of like loyalty. So these guys took a chance on me. I really would like to do the follow-up with them, too.
All right. Good for you. Yeah, that's what took this book so long to get to me. That's the technical problems that Tom was talking about.
Yeah.
That might have been it.
The other thing is that line varnish they put on the front cover, which says kill, 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 kill in the background.
Mm-hmm.
That was a beautiful touch. I've never seen anything like that before.
Who was responsible for the cover artwork?
Jim Pasco put that together. We kind of did a collaboration on the pill on the front. Bill sent... Jim sent me a few concept pieces, and a lot of them had pills on the cover, and one had just one big pill, as they kill Whitey, Ken Harville. And I said, well, I got a funny idea. This may be kind of bizarre, but you know, listen to me and tell me what you think. What if we stuffed this pill with some of the animals that appear in the book, like bees and rats and fish? And I said, you know what, that might work. And I think the initial idea might have been it was just cheaper to put only bees behind that pill, but I like that simplified aspect of this pill full of bees because it's a real horrible image. But
it was a real horrible scene with the bees too in
your
book.
Yeah.
But tell me about let's not judge this book by its cover. tell me about the let's get into the book itself and the writing process. I mean, how does the writing process work for you? This is one thing that people who want to write. And they sit down and somehow they just don't know what to do. This is what I'm told anyway.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know whether they should be taking notes for a book. They don't know whether they should be writing a chapter at a time. They don't know whether they should just sit down until it's done. I mean, how does the creative process work for you?
With this book, I felt like it. I had taken a couple stabs at writing short stories, and I wrote this one short story that. Basically had this whole plot scrunched down to like 30 pages. And I liked it. It was a funny little short story, but it was just could not be told in 30 pages. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you turn it into a novel? And so I did that. And once I got started on the novel, it just possessed me. I couldn't stop. You know, I'd get up every morning at 5 in the morning, sometimes 4 in the morning, and just write for hours before I went to work. And all day at work, I'd be thinking about the novel, and as soon as I got home, I'd start writing again. And I finished it just in between working my day job in about a year, and then I just kind of recrafted and rewrote it. But the initial storyline, it really carried me. I just kind of, almost like as a medium for the story. But then when you get to the revision and the rewriting, then it becomes more of a craft where you're just kind of fine-tuning and you're really getting into the art of writing.
Well, tell me, for a writer and for a writer who's just completed his first book, how did it work with the editorial process? I mean, you sent this book to Pascoe and Fassbender, and did they edit it? And if they did, I mean, how did you take that? And how did that whole editorial process work?
Ugly Town does very little of that. They do in my case, they had a lot of input on critique as far as there were certain elements that they found lacking. There was something missing, but they didn't know what it was. In my case, they felt that I had I wrote in sort of a three-act screenplay structure, but they felt that I had three separate novels. They were just three distinct stories, and they weren't tied together. And they wanted some stronger through line to tie those three elements together, but they didn't really know what. And so they kind of left it hanging with me, and I ended up combining a couple of characters, which became Macy, and she became the through story. So in that case, it's just really nice, though. They just kind of give this very sensible, very solid critiques, but not telling me what to do, and just kind of left it up to me to address their concerns. And then there was, like, minor things they wanted me to change. And I disagreed, and I wanted to keep certain elements, and they were good with that. So it was just a great collaboration where they suggested things, and on the other hand, they would let me just kind of have the freedom to tell my tale the way I wanted to tell it.
Well, Tommy, how do you walk through the world right now as a writer? I mean, you get up in your little southern New England town, and you go to work, or you walk by your neighbors, and do people look at you differently? Especially since you've got the cachet of being a writer, and plus you've written a book that it certainly wouldn't be on the living room table of the Cleavers.
Yeah, I don't tell many people. Most people don't know I've written a novel, especially with my job. I have a lot of contact with people all over the country and all over the world in my job. So I don't really tell people. I'm trying to protect the image of my company by not letting them know I wrote a book called Kill Whitey.
What happens when the boss finds out?
Oh, he loves it. He loves the
That's
book.
Good. That's good.
Yeah. My coworkers are happy about it, and they're excited. But it's kind of like living a double life now. I've got my normal everyday life with my day job, and then I've got this writer life. It is cool. I got to tell you, I've been getting emails from other authors around the country, and I do feel like just before I got on the phone with you, I got off the phone with another author out in L.A., and she was talking about how there's tribes, and she feels like there's just this writer's tribe, and I find myself being drawn towards that tribe now. I really find myself being drawn towards wanting to go out to L.A. and picking up and start a new life.
It could happen.
Yeah.
I mean, do you see yourself leaving an old life, starting a new life, going there, becoming a full-time novelist and,
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, I always liked telling stories when I was a kid, and I always did little, like, cartoons and stuff like that. I feel like I've been a storyteller all my life, but I just never really, had the courage or whatever to just take the jump and do it.
Yeah, you
now
broke,
that I stumbled into it, why not go with it?
You broke through some barrier. Good luck to you.
Thanks.
And we've been speaking with Ken Harville, author of Kill Whitey, book number one, an Ugly Town publication. Ken, keep in touch with us. Let us know when the new book comes out, and we'll have you back on the show.
That'd be great.
Hey, my name is Stephen Nestor, and you've been listening to Poets of the Tabloid Murder.
Thanks, Stephen.